Let's open our Bibles, please, to Luke chapter 19. I'm sure you've heard many times on Palm Sunday the story of Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem and the whole story of when all of Jerusalem came out and hailed him as king and Messiah and laid down the palm branches. And then a week later, that very same crowd was shouting, "Crucify him. We won't have this man to rule over us," and so on. But did that ever really happen? I mean, in history, did that ever actually take place? No. Never happened. And you may be surprised to discover what actually did happen. And you may also be surprised to discover what the practical application that God's Word gives us for our day-to-day lives. Many times you may hear the story of Jesus' triumphal entry and not hear anything but the story, not hear it, what that means for our daily living. But that's right there in the text as well. Let's take a close look at Luke 19 and see if we can gain an understanding of what actually took place that Sunday. Verse 28 of Luke 19 says, "After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem." So he steps out ahead of his disciples and takes the lead and starts going off to Jerusalem. Now we want to stop right there. You may want to circle Jerusalem because that's profoundly significant in this whole thing. Jerusalem is the capital city of the Jews, and in the book of Luke ends up representing the Jewish people. So Jesus' interaction with Jerusalem is the same as his interaction with the Jewish people. It's the heart and soul of Israel, and it represents the religious aspect. It's where the temple was, it's where the religious leadership was. And so this is a very, very dramatic point in Jesus' life, because throughout the Gospels, and especially in Luke, Jerusalem has been set up as the ultimate fulfillment, the place of destiny for Jesus, the place of his final goal. Now, I want to show you that so you can understand how important it is. Turn back to Luke 9, chapter 9. And I want to take just a moment to show you how this... Now, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all tell the same story, the story of Jesus' life on earth. The story goes like this. Basically, Jesus left heaven, came to earth. He was born to the Virgin Mary. He lived a life and then began his public ministry and did a whole bunch of astonishing miracles, absolutely the most profoundly powerful display of God's power ever given in his miracles. Then he made his exit from the world. And it's on that exit from the world that most of the attention is focused. In Luke's gospel, his coming into the world and his first 30 years or so are described in the first two chapters. And then in the next seven chapters, all of his ministry is described up until chapter 9. That brings us to chapter 9, just over a third of the way into the book, and there we read about the transfiguration. And in the transfiguration, he takes Peter, James, and John up onto a mountain, and his appearance changes, his clothes change, he gets really bright and shiny and like a flash of lightning, all that. And Moses and Elijah show up and start talking with Jesus. Now, have you ever wondered what they were talking about? What were they saying? What were they discussing? I've heard people speculate about that. We don't have to speculate. I can tell you what they were saying. It's right there in verse 31 of Luke 9. It says, they spoke about his departure, his exit, which was about to bring, he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Very important verse in Luke. By Luke chapter 9, Luke is saying the Son of God has arrived in this world, he's lived his life, he's done his ministry, he's carried everything out, and now he's about to make his exit, his departure, which he's going to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. And from here on out, the focus of everything is on this destination of Jerusalem. Now skip down to verse 51. It says, as the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Okay, now he's going to start making his march down there. He's going to wrap this whole thing up. Luke is signaling here that he's coming to the end of the story. But then you flip ahead and you see, wow, we've got 15 more chapters to go in this book. It's kind of like if you're watching a movie and you know the movie ends at 10 o'clock and you're getting towards the end of the story and it's about to wrap up in the storyline and you look at your watch, it's only 8:30. You know, I got an hour and a half to go in this movie yet. Evidently, it's all about the very end, which is exactly the case in the book of Luke and the rest of the Gospels. It's all about the very end. There are three other times when Jesus makes a trip to Jerusalem in the Gospels, and all three times he gets there in one verse. It takes him one verse to get there. Here, he sets out for Jerusalem in chapter 9 and arrives in chapter 19, in the verse that we started with. 10 chapters to get there. So when we get to Jesus' final march down to Jerusalem, the pace slows way down. And from chapter 9 on, Jerusalem is the focus. Look at chapter 13. I'll show you another example. 13:31. It says, at that time the Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you. In verse 32, Jesus answers. He says, go tell that fox, I will drive out demons, heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I'll reach my goal. In any case, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside of Jerusalem. Tell Herod, I said, look, I don't have time for you. I've got to get to Jerusalem. I have to reach my goal. I've got to get to Jerusalem. And then he gets to thinking about Jerusalem. Look at verse 34. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who are sent to you, how often I long to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, now your house is left to you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Now, it's kind of an interesting thought. The time is coming when Jesus is going to come into Jerusalem and they're going to hail him and shout, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And it's at that time that they'll be restored. It's at that time that they'll be gathered together like a hen gathers her chicks. All these promises in the Old Testament will be fulfilled. So now you've got this amazing thought of hope injected into the narrative here in Luke, there in chapter 13. But still, the focus is it's when Jesus goes to Jerusalem and then Jerusalem hails him and says, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Look at chapter 18. Just kind of whiz through Luke here. Chapter 18, verse 31. Jesus took the 12 aside and told them, we're going to Jerusalem, and everything that's been written by the prophets about the Son of Man will be fulfilled. He keeps reminding us of that. He's on a mission to arrive at the exact time, the exact place of his destiny. Nothing can stop him. Nothing can blow him off the track. Not the crowds, not the king, not Satan, not Peter, not inhospitable Samaritans, nobody. And if we had time, we could go into this whole section and show how Luke has this technique of he keeps heightening the drama and heightening the tension as he keeps pointing out landmarks on the way as they keep getting closer and closer. It would be kind of like if you were reading a story of somebody who were going to face some earth-changing event when he arrived, say, in Colorado Springs, walking from Boulder on foot. And as you go down, you get these ominous landmarks. I mean, in the narrative, okay, now he's passing Mile High Stadium. And then a few chapters later, okay, he's talking to some people, and back in the background you notice, oh, he's in Castle Rock. You know, a little bit later, he's somewhere, he's doing something in Monument. And then the next story, you know, he's going along and you see jets flying overhead. And you say, oh, he's approaching the Academy. He's right at the outskirts of the Springs now. That's exactly the kind of thing Luke is doing. So let's go back to Luke 19 now. And you can see then what a big deal it is when you get to chapter 19 and verse 28 comes up and it says, after Jesus said this, he went on ahead approaching Jerusalem. Finally, he's getting there after 10 chapters. He's arriving. But before he gets into the town, actually crosses into the city, he does something very intentional. Look at verse 29. Jesus is going to purposely present himself as the king. It says, as he approached Bethphage and Bethany at the hill called Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples. Now notice that Jesus initiates this whole scene. It all starts with him. I say that because some liberal theologians have suggested that Jesus never really meant to be taken as a Messiah. He never claimed to be Messiah. He never claimed to be God. He just sort of got swept along with the fervor of the crowds, and they kind of got caught up in that, and they kind of, in their euphoria, took him against his will. This is not a picture of Jesus being swept away against his will. He's going along and he sends the disciples, and by sending them, he is setting the whole triumphal entry scene into motion. And there's a certain audacity to that from the human perspective. Jesus is a fugitive here. He's wanted. There's a warrant out for his arrest. John, in John's account, all four Gospels tells the account of this entry into Jerusalem. In John's account, he starts out with this verse. You don't have to turn there, but it's John 11:57. It says, the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so that they might arrest him. So there's a warrant out for his arrest. He's wanted. In the movies, when a hero is wanted in a city, and then he has the audacity to actually go back into that city. Usually, the way he does it, he'll put on a disguise, and then he'll sneak in there at dark or whatever. Jesus doesn't put on a disguise. He doesn't sneak around at night. He stops at the outskirts of town and gets a royal mount and a crowd of people and sets up a huge demonstration that will attract everybody's attention. And he does this on purpose. Look what he tells the disciples, verse 30. He says, go to the village ahead of you, and as you enter, you will find a colt tied there with which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. And if anyone asks you, why are you untying it? Tell him, the Lord needs it. Some commentators assume that Jesus had made prior arrangements with these owners. I don't know why they assume that. They offer no basis for that assumption. I mean, he might have. We don't know. Since, though, that it's a major theme in Luke, Jesus' ability to know what people are going to say and what people are going to do, and his supernatural knowledge in general, I think it's more likely that Luke is portraying this as a prophecy. Jesus knows exactly how they'll respond, even though he doesn't. I mean, he hasn't been in this town recently, and yet he knows about this donkey. He knows the fact that it's tied up. He knows it's there with its mother. He knows that it's never been ridden. And he knows that if these two disciples go and say these words, that exactly how the owners will respond. Be like in our day, if he said, there's a car parked in Denver, it's, you know, a such intersection of this street and that street, keys will be in it, go there, jump in, and drive it back. And if the owners say anything, just tell them the Lord needs it. I'm sure they were hoping that that part didn't happen. I'm sure these disciples were thinking, I hope the owners aren't around. Because that sounds a little odd, but it does happen. Verse 32, those who were sent ahead went and found just exactly what he told them. Verse 33 says, and as they were untying the colt, sure enough, the owners see it, and they asked, why are you untying the colt? And they replied, the Lord needs it. That's kind of an interesting use of words in Luke, because the word Lord, as you know, means owner. And the word owners is the same words, kurios, both times. So in verse 33, when it says the owners ask, it's the Lord's, the owners. And so the owners say, why are you taking the colt? And they say, because the owner needs it. That's what the word Lord means. Jesus is portrayed as a king whose needs supersede the needs of his subjects. He's the king, and he has the right to commandeer a mule if he wants to. And that's exactly what Jesus does. He doesn't have his own colt. He doesn't have anything. And so he commandeers a colt. And we find in the other Gospels it's a colt of a mule. It's good that the Lord arranged, I think, that these owners to be present, as much as that might have made the disciples uncomfortable. It's good because this doesn't look now like, you know, grand theft donkey. The clear implication is that when they said this, then the owners allowed them to take it willingly. And the fact that it's shared ownership of this animal, plural owners, doesn't complicate Jesus' prophecy in the least. They still respond exactly as Jesus said. Unless you think that Jesus inflicted some hardship on these people, don't worry about that. First of all, remember, number one, they willingly gave their animal, and number two, we find in Mark 11:13 that Jesus said that he would return it right away, as soon as he's done. So by setting all this into motion, Jesus, what he's doing here is presenting himself as king. Then in verse 35, his disciples respond by treating him as king. Verse 35 says they brought it to Jesus, threw their cloaks on the colt, and put Jesus on it. They did that in order to make the statement that they regarded him to be king. And you have to understand, I'm not going to take the time, we don't have the time this morning, but there's a fascinating story in 1 Kings 1 about when King David was very old and he was about to die, and Adonijah tried to usurp the throne, and he installed himself in this major ceremony as king, and he had David's commander of his military there, Joab. He had the high priest on his side. He had gathered all this support. He made himself king. David's in bed. He hears this. He says, I got to act fast. He says, get my son Solomon, put him on my royal donkey, and send him on a ride through Jerusalem. That's exactly what they do, and immediately the city sees that, and they regard Solomon. And from that moment on, Solomon is firmly entrenched as king of Judah and Israel. And Adonijah's party comes to a sudden end. Everybody leaves. And so you can, so that's what the background of this. And you can see that by the crowd's response that they understood. Verse 36, as he went along, people spread their cloaks on the road in front of him. They carpet the road with their clothes for him to step on. This is a recognition that God himself has chosen Jesus to be king. 2 Kings 1:9, when Elisha anointed Jehu as king of Judah, when the people saw that, 2 Kings 9:13 says, they hurried and took their cloaks and spread them under him on the bare steps, and they blew the trumpet and shouted, Jehu is king. So Jesus' disciples here are treating him as king. He's claiming to be king. They're treating him as king. Unless there be any confusion on that, look at what happens next. They just explicitly proclaim him to be king. Verse 37, when he came near the place where the road of, goes down the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd began joyfully to praise God. This is a dramatic moment here, because up until this point, they've been climbing uphill. You can't see Jerusalem from where they were. But now they've gotten to the top of the hill, and they're coming up over the ridge, and right at this point, suddenly Jerusalem becomes visible in all of its spectacular glory, and the sun shining off of the roof of the temple and all of that. And they can suddenly see all that, and it has a rush of excitement that comes from their mouths and shouts of praise. The whole crowd of disciples began joyfully to praise God in loud voices for all the miracles they had seen. Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, and praise in heaven and glory in the highest. So they begin praising him. It's significant that they say this unusual phrase, peace in heaven. As Jesus would later proclaim to Pilate, his kingdom was not of this world at this stage, at this point. His throne is in heaven. At his second coming, he'll come and bring peace on earth, establish his earthly reign in a physical way. But at this point, he's being crowned king of heaven. And the peace that he's about to accomplish is a peace in heaven. After Jesus' death and resurrection and ascension into heaven, there will still be wars, and there'll still not be peace on earth, but there will be peace with God. He'll have paved the way for sinful man to have peace with God. So it's peace in heaven. And in the flow of the book of Luke, all of the emotions of the reader peak in this verse right here when he comes up over this ridge and sees Jerusalem, and all his disciples begin shouting praises. Remember back in chapter 13 when Jesus said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I long to gather you together and restore you and to bless you and to bring all the things that have been promised to you, but you weren't willing. Therefore, it's not going to happen until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So for six chapters, the reader in Luke is reading this and has been saying, come on, Jerusalem, just say it. Just welcome him and pray, realize who he is. And say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, and embrace him as your Messiah. And then you'll get all the promises and all the restoration that's promised. And so now Jesus makes his final triumphal entry into Jerusalem, and the crowd is shouting, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. And you read that verse in verse 38, and that's where the emotions peak. You think, wow, this is it? Is this it? I mean, is Jerusalem welcoming Jesus as its Messiah here? Is this the wonderful, euphoric high point of Jesus' whole life, the people rallying around him in praise? No. Not at all. In fact, if you look ahead, peek down to verse 41. Look at Jesus. Look how Jesus feels about this whole thing. Look what he's doing in verse 41. He's crying. This crowd is singing praises to him as their king. Jesus is riding along on a donkey crying. Why? The reason why is if you look very carefully at the text, you'll see Jerusalem is not embracing him at all here, and they never do. You say, but wait a minute. I thought the whole triumphal entry story was Jesus rides into Jerusalem and all of Jerusalem praises him as Messiah and lays down the palm branches and all that. And, you know, what about these shouts here? Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Look carefully. You'll see that Jerusalem never says that. These are Jesus' disciples saying that. This crowd traveling with Jesus that says that. It says that in verse 37. It's Jesus' disciples saying it, not the city of Jerusalem. Look at verse 39. The Pharisees in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, rebuke your disciples. Jerusalem doesn't embrace him as Messiah, not even at the triumphal entry. And we see that in all four Gospels. Again, I'm not going to take the time. It's in the manuscripts if you want to get that. But that's evident in all four Gospels. The most the city of Jerusalem ever does is in the Gospel of Matthew, where they hear all this, and they come out to see him, and then they say, "Who is this?" That's as far as Jerusalem gets. Who is this? Now, I'm not going to diminish the fact that his disciples were saying it. That's wonderful. I'm glad they were saying it. That's significant that they were saying it. It's significant that Jesus accepted it. I don't know if you thought about that, but Jesus accepts the praise. Verse 39, the Pharisees say, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples. Look, they're calling you Messiah. They're worshiping you. They're praising you. They're treating you as if you're God. Rebuke them." And Jesus replied, "You know, you're right. I'm just a lowly teacher, a wandering moralist, and I never really claimed to be Messiah, and all I'm trying to do is teach a few lessons on ethics, and I don't have any aspirations to be worshipped." Is that what he says? No. Look what he says. I mean, that's what the people in the Jesus seminar would have you think that he would say, but that's not how Jesus responded at all. Did Jesus shun praise? Did he rebuke his disciples? You decide. Verse 40. He replied to the Pharisees, "I tell you, if they keep quiet, the stones will cry out." It wouldn't matter. These people stop worshiping me, the earth itself will start. That's how essential it is that I be worshipped. It's imperative. You know, I'm not claiming to be anybody special. I'm just a roaming peasant, and I'm not making any unusual claims about myself. But if the people stop worshiping me, the stones will cry out and do it. If that doesn't strike you as an unusual claim, think about how you'd react if somebody else said it. What if I said it? What if you saw some people worshiping me, and you said, "Daryl, don't you think you should rebuke them for that?" And I said, "Look, if they stop worshiping me, the walls of this building will cry out in praise." I mean, you put the words of Jesus into anyone else, and it's just blasphemous. If you don't believe Jesus claims to be God, that's one thing. But don't try and imagine that he never made the claims. In verse 40, what he's doing is validating everything his disciples are doing and saying. So far in the sermon, no big surprises. This is just exactly turning out to be what you've heard. Jesus rides into Jerusalem as king and gets all this praise and all that. What you may not have heard much about is verse 41. Let's take a look at verse 41, where the king cries. As he approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept over it, and he said, "If you, you see the emotion in that, had only known on this day what would bring you peace." He's speaking now to Jerusalem. If you thought of the triumphal entry as a moment of euphoria when Jesus enjoyed the acceptance of the praises of Jerusalem, think again. The triumphal entry was a tragic, heartbreaking moment in which Jesus sat on a donkey and cried. And the word translated wept in verse 41 is a strong word. It literally means wailed. And it's a word that emphasizes the noise being made. It was a loud, noisy kind of a cry, wailing, that comes up from Jesus. And when Jesus started that, my guess is the crowd goes silent. This is not the kind of behavior that they expected at all. Some people have said that he's crying here because he knows he's about to die, but that's not it. He's not crying because of his fate. He's crying because of their fate. Look what it says in verse 43. Jesus looks at the people who come out of Jerusalem and he says, "The days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you and encircle you and hem you in on every side, and they will dash you to the ground and you and your children within your walls, and they will not leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." He could see into the future, and he could see that Jerusalem was going to reject him, and as a result, they were going to be judged and slaughtered. And Jesus looked over the city, and as he's looking over the city, he's not seeing just the normal hustle and bustle of another Passover holiday. He could see 40 years into the future. He could see blood spilled all over, and he could hear the screams, and he could see the bodies of the women and children laying dead all over the city, and the incredible massacre that came. And he sees that and he weeps. Verse 43, your enemies will build an embankment against you, encircle you, hem you in. That's, you're going to be surrounded. It's not going to be like, you know, the war with Iraq, where the population was spared and even the government leaders were allowed to leave ahead of time if they wanted to and be flee to safety. Jesus is describing a war in which the attacking army is going to surround the whole city. There will be no way out for anyone, not any citizen, not any woman, not any child. No movement in or out. And the purpose of that is to cut them off of their supplies so that they run out of food and they begin to starve and they weaken, and then the slaughter begins. So no matter who you were, there's no way out of the bloodbath. Verse 44, they'll dash you to the ground, you and your children within your walls. They're not going to leave one stone on another because you did not recognize the time of, literally, God's visitation. The time when God came to bless you. You wouldn't recognize it. So the slaughter of 70 AD comes, and as we know from other passages, the slaughter of 70 AD was just a picture of the final judgment that's going to take place. And so it makes Jesus weep. Now, can you imagine this? I mean, can you just kind of picture this scene in your mind? Most of those people had one idea about what the Messiah was, a military deliverer. That's the Messiah. That's what that's, as far as they're concerned, that's all the Messiah is good for, somebody who's going to come and have a strong military and kick the Romans out. Someone like David, you know, or Samson. That's what a Messiah does. Someone to, and so you're sitting there with that kind of a mentality in your house on this Sunday, and somebody all of a sudden comes and bangs on your door and says, hey, come with me to the city gates. You're not going to believe what's going on. There's this guy riding into town on a royal mount, and a big crowd is crowded around him, hailing him as the Messiah. And they say that the Messiah has finally arrived. And so you go running out, wondering if this, you know, what this Messiah is going to be like. Is he going to enlist me right on the spot into his army? Should I bring my sword? What, you know, what's going to happen here? Could this really be true? Is God bringing deliverance finally? Is it possible to conquer the Romans at this point? What kind of a warrior is this going to be? And so you arrive, and here's this guy riding a donkey, which is a gesture of peace. That's what it means to ride a donkey into a city. It's a gesture of peace. And he's sitting on that donkey crying. And you're there because you want to hear his battle plan, his military strategy. How's he going to defeat Rome? What's his technique going to be? What is the strategy? And so you listen to what he has to say, and here's what you hear. Your enemies are going to come and surround you and then slaughter you and your children, and no stone will be left on another? They're going to come and just make short work of you, and you're going to be wiped out and slaughtered with your children? Interesting battle plan there, Jesus. You look at your friend and say, this is some Messiah you've discovered. Some deliverer. In this moment, when anybody else would have been euphoric and happy, Jesus is weeping. Jesus is so aware of the way things really are. He's never faked out by external appearances, physical appearances. As he can see reality. You know, we always get so worked up if we can just get a crowd to show up to something. Whenever it seems like whenever a large crowd showed up around Jesus, it made him weep. And he wept because they wouldn't recognize the time of God's coming to them. Which is another way of saying what he said in verse 42. They didn't realize that this is the day that God is offering them peace. He's here on terms of peace. The songs about praise in heaven, peace in heaven, that his disciples are singing, gets Jesus thinking about peace, evidently. What they're saying is true about heaven, but it would be true of Jerusalem on earth if Jerusalem would just understand what's happening here. That phrase, the things that would bring you peace, appears one other place in the Bible. It's in chapter 14, verse 32. You don't have to turn there, but you remember, it's the story that Jesus tells about the king who, he says, you got to count the cost. If a king realizes he doesn't have enough forces to face the army that's coming, he's going to send out a delegation to ask for terms of peace. That's the same phrase, terms of peace. And so the idea here is Jesus is there offering terms of peace. Picture is Jesus is approaching Jerusalem for the last time as a king, coming to a rebellious city, a hotbed of resistance against his kingly authority. And he's there willing to offer them peace, but peace on his terms only. And the tears come from the fact that he can see that they're going to reject the terms of peace. The king who wanted to display his power as a threat, might come riding into town on a war horse. But it was a king riding on a donkey was a gesture of arriving in peace. And that happened to fulfill the prophecy of Zechariah 9:9, which says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion." This is written hundreds of years earlier. "Shout, daughter of Jerusalem, see your king comes to you riding and having salvation, gentle, and riding on a donkey, on the colt, a foal of a donkey. And I'll take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle of bow will be broken, and he will proclaim peace to the nations, and he'll rule all over the world." He's going to bring peace. Jesus is fulfilling that there. He didn't come in his first coming to bring judgment. He came to bring peace. John 12:47, "I didn't come to judge the world, but to save it," Jesus said. He came the first time as a sacrificial lamb who would die for the sins of the world and make possible peace with God. And they could have had peace with God. But instead, by the end of this week, they attack God and kill his son. So verse 42 says, "You didn't understand it because it's hidden from your eyes. You're blind to it." As Jesus has made clear more than once, refusal to accept the truth results eventually in an inability to accept the truth. Understand that? Refusal to accept the truth ends up in an inability to accept the truth, and that's where they are now. It's hidden from them. They can't see it. It's too late. They would have been open to Jesus if he'd have come on their terms, though. I mean, that's pretty obvious. If Jesus had only been a seeker-sensitive Messiah, they would have loved him. He would have handled this much differently. Can you imagine how he'd handle it? If he had just read a book on church growth, the book would have told him, "Look, don't you realize that in the modern time, people are not interested in a humble Messiah who's more concerned with peace with God than he is with war with Rome?" Seeker-sensitive Jesus would have spent a couple of weeks prior to coming into Jerusalem taking a survey to find out from people what really has in the past turned you off to messianic claims. Then he would have found out that people's felt needs centered on deliverance from Rome. He could have addressed their felt needs. And he would have, if he would have taken a survey, he could have discovered that he could get a huge crowd if he just came in with a war horse and weapons and talked about military conquest. You know, a survey also would have helped him understand that driving the people out of their own temple with a whip is also a big turnoff. Which is what he does next. You know, there's so many people who really want Jesus, but only a Jesus of their own devising. Only on their own terms. They want a Jesus who will come and conquer all their opponents rather than the true Jesus who comes to conquer their own hearts. Jesus said, "This judgment is going to come," verse 44, "because you did not recognize the time of God's coming to you." None of it had to happen. 70 AD didn't have to happen. This was a day when the Jews are embracing Jesus as Messiah. Why didn't they listen to this? If that's what they're doing, if Jerusalem were embracing Jesus at this point, why wouldn't they listen to this? There's only one exception, one explanation of why they didn't listen. They didn't listen because they didn't believe. They didn't believe what he's saying. They don't think judgment's going to come. If a prophet came to you and said this in your town, a prophet from God, and said, "Look, you're going to be slaughtered. Your children are going to be slaughtered if you don't do what I tell you to do," you would grab hold of him and say, "Tell me, how can we avert that? How can we avoid that?" If you even had the slightest thought that it might be true. But they don't do that. Jesus forecasts this horrible disaster, and everyone just stands there and listens to it and says, "Oh, well, whatever." And then they just go on with their life. They don't believe it at all. So that's the account. Jesus came and he was hailed as Messiah, not by Jerusalem, but by his disciples. Rejected by Jerusalem. Now, what is the significance of this passage? Why is it recorded? And what is the role that it plays in biblical theology? And what does the Lord want us to do in response? What is a practical application for our lives? To answer that question, we need to do something that few people do when they study this passage, is pay careful attention to the context. The account of Jesus' approach to Jerusalem begins in verse 28 and then ends with Jesus talking about the bloodbath that's going to happen in Jerusalem. So if it begins in 28, let's look back at verse 27 and we'll see what's going on there. What does verse 27 say? Isn't that interesting? The king says to those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me. You see the connection there? The last verse of this parable, Jesus is talking about a king who is being rejected by his subjects and bringing punishment on them. You say, oh, wow, well, maybe the triumphal entry story is an explanation of what's going on in this parable in Luke, starting in verse 11. So let's look back at verse 11. Let's zip through that parable real quick, and we'll see what we can pick up here. Verse 11, Luke 19. While they were listening to this, he went on to tell them a parable because... Now, this is interesting. He says why he's telling the parable. He's telling the parable because he was near Jerusalem. Oh, wow, this is Luke, and we're building up to this Jerusalem for 10 chapters, and now he's near Jerusalem, and the people thought that the kingdom of God was going to appear at once, right away. He's been building up this idea, and there finally this grand climax in Jerusalem is about to happen. And so obviously Jesus' followers are thinking, okay, now the full-blown kingdom of God is about to be put in place at once. And so Jesus is going to, he needs to tell a parable to set that right. He needs to tell a parable to prepare them for reality, which is that there's going to be a period of time in between this moment and the final full coming of the end picture of the kingdom, the culmination of the kingdom. There's a gap in between, a time gap. And he needs to give them instructions about what to do during that time gap. And so he tells this parable, verse 12. He said, a man of noble birth went to a distant country to have himself appointed king and then return. This is a story about a king, a guy who's noble, but he leaves his place, goes somewhere else. He's crowned as king there. He's gone for a while, then comes back. Verse 13, so he called 10 of his servants and gave them 10 minas. It's a denomination of money. And he says, put this money to work and until I come back. And then verse 14, but his subjects hated him. It's important we stop right there because it's a very important point and it's very easy to miss. There's two different groups being talked about here. And you have to understand that to understand the meaning of the parable. Remember when I told you how to interpret parables? I told you that there's usually one major point for every major character in the parable. This parable has three major characters: the king, the servants, and the subjects. Servants and the subjects are two totally different groups. The servants are, to them, he says, make use of this money until I return. But the subjects, look at them in verse 14. The subjects hated him and sent a delegation after him to say, we don't want this man to be our king. Now remember why Jesus is telling this parable. It's because the people were thinking that he's going to bring the final form of the kingdom right away, and Jesus wants to correct that. And so he tells a parable about the person who's going away to receive his crown and then comes back. And so the whole point of all this is he's saying, I'm going away. I'm leaving. And the implication is that there's going to be a fair amount of time, enough time for these servants to get return on an investment of money. So a significant amount of time, he's going to be gone. Verse 15, and this parable is all about what the two groups of people do while he's gone, and then what happens when he returns. Verse 15, he was made king while he was gone, and then he returned home, and he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained from it. And the first one said, sir, your mina has earned 10 more. Well done, my good servant. His master replied, because you have been trustworthy with a very small matter, take charge of 10 cities. This is very similar, I'm sure you noticed, to the parable of the talents in Matthew 24, where he gives them 10 talents and 5 talents and 1 talent. Same thing happens. The first guy doubles his money. But here the reward is different. There, the guy just gets more talents. He's rewarded with more talents. Here, the reward is ruling over cities because it has to do with having a key position in a kingdom because this whole thing is about the coming of this kingdom. And so he's saying you get 10 cities. Verse 18, the second came and said, sir, your mina has earned 5 more. His master replied, take charge of 5 cities. Then the other servant came, sir, here's your mina. I've kept it laid away in a piece of cloth. I was afraid of you because you're a hard man and you take what you did not put in and take out what you did not put in and you reap what you did not sow. And so the master replied, I will judge you by your own words, you wicked servant. You knew, did you, that I'm a hard man, taking out what I did not put in, reaping what I did not sow? Why then didn't you put my money on deposit so that when I came back I could have collected it with interest? And then he said to those standing by, take his mina away from him, give it to the one who has 10 minas. Typical human response, verse 25, "Sir," they said, "he already has 10. And verse 26, he replied, "I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given, but as for the one who has nothing, even what he does have will be taken away." He's saying now to his disciples, look, the final form of the kingdom is not coming right now. I'm leaving you for a while, and your concern is to make good use of the resources I've given you until I come back. And now you expect the parable to be over. You expect it to end right here. You've forgotten about the other group by now, the subjects. But Jesus hasn't forgotten about them because they're a major point of the parable. So there's one more verse. But verse 27, the subjects. "As for those enemies of mine who did not want me to be king over them, bring them here and kill them in front of me." After Jesus had said this, he went on ahead to Jerusalem, and he, approaching Bethphage and Bethany and the hill called Mount of Olives, sent two of his disciples saying, "Go to the village ahead of you and get a colt tied up there," and so on. There's no break. Luke doesn't stop after verse 27 with a paragraph division and a subtitle and a new section heading and all that. It's just all one continuous thought. The big question of why Jesus is crying at his own triumphal entry is this. Why was Jesus crying at his triumphal entry? Because it wasn't a triumphal entry. It was a humble exit. Jesus' final arrival into Jerusalem, the crucifixion, the resurrection, and ascension was all his exit from this world. It was just his leaving. It's not the story of Jesus coming, it's the story of Jesus leaving. It's the beginning of his exit. And all that's in verses 12 to 14. You see it there? A man of noble birth went, he left, he went to a distant country to have himself appointed as king. The distant country is heaven. Jesus left this earth and went there to be crowned as king. He died and was raised and was ascended into heaven. He went there to be crowned as king. This isn't the story of Jesus' coronation. If you want the story of Jesus' coronation, it's in heaven. It's in Romans 1:4, where it says he was declared there with power to be the Son of God by virtue of his resurrection. That's where he was crowned as king. That's the great coronation. Then verse 13, he called his 10 of his servants and with the minas, and he said, "Put this money to work." Those are his disciples. Those are the ones hailing him as king, putting down the palm branches and all that. Verse 14, but his subjects hated him, sent a delegation saying, "We don't want this man to be our king." What is that? That's Jerusalem. That's the trial before Pilate where they say, "We have no king but Caesar." If you want the triumphal entry, the Bible does record a triumphal entry of Christ, but it's not in Luke 19. There is a place that describes him coming in glorious triumphal power, arriving with a sword and a white horse, but it's not Luke 19. It's what? Revelation 19, yeah. That's where he comes as a mighty conqueror. For now, he just comes on a colt of a donkey, bringing terms of peace to Jerusalem. So what is the application for us, the practical application of Luke 19? What is the modern-day application? It depends on if you're a servant or a subject, right? If you're a servant, then you have a very, very strong warning. Because what happens to this lazy, wicked servant is not a pretty picture. If you're a servant, the implication is that you need to take your spiritual resources and the opportunities you've been given, your spiritual gifts, your abilities, your ministry, your calling, and be faithful to that until he gets back. Very, very strong warning on that. Live your life as though there's a major kingdom at stake and a major role in that kingdom at stake, because your position in the kingdom is related to your faithfulness now as a servant. So if you're a servant, that's the application for you. That's what Palm Sunday means to you. And if you're a subject, one of those people who's not bowed the knee to the kingship of Jesus Christ, the application is really easy. You better become a servant. Because I promise you, if you're still in the category, if you're in the category of these subjects, that group, you don't want to still be in that group when you arrive at verse 27, when they get punished, when the king gets back. Things get really ugly in verse 27 for them. But right now, we're not in verse 27 yet. The king's still gone. There's still time to switch over to become one of the servants. Because he hasn't come back in justice and wrath yet. As of right now, he's still offering the terms of peace. and reconciliation with God. Paul described his ministry that way in 2 Corinthians 5:19. He says, God in Christ reconciling the world to himself. Same thing, bringing peace. That's what it means to bring peace with God. Reconciling the world to himself, not counting their sins against them, entrusting to us the message of reconciliation. So we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us, beseeching you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God, accept the terms of peace. It's just another way of saying what Jesus said. Oh, Jerusalem, if you'd only understood the terms of peace. So in this account, Jesus, the king, has come to his rebel subjects and offered them peace, terms of peace, while the time lasts. And the terms of peace are simple. Lay down your arms, especially the weapons of self-righteousness and self-sufficiency. Admit your defeat, accept your own full and free pardon, total amnesty that's offered, and swear your allegiance to the new king of your life. Jesus wept over Jerusalem because he knew they weren't going to repent. Is he weeping over you? Or are you a servant who's dangerously close to hearing the rebuke, you wicked, lazy servant? Or are you living a life driven by the longing to hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant?